you know, 30% of people in homeless shelters are mentally ill, 24% of people in state prisons are mentally ill. You know, there are a lot of people to be concerned about.
We want to thank you for being with us, Jamie, and
thank
for writing
so
this
much.
Book, Mental Lithium Love and Losing My Mind. That does it for today's show. If you'd like to get a copy, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Accepting applications for a paid year-long news fellowship. Details at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Democracy Now! Is our news hour.
Hope you might join us on New Year's Day of 2018 from 8 a.m. to noon for a special Michael Wells Memorial Dawn Concert. Michael Wells was a longtime KABU volunteer, programmer, and worked as station manager and board member. Michael passed away last year. His many friends from KBOO and his family thought it would be a nice gesture to honor him by having a special Dawn Concert program to start the new year. In the early days of KABU, Dawn Concert was a regularly scheduled morning program with a variety of program hosts. That's Dawn Concert honoring the late Michael Wells from 8 a.m. to noon on Monday, January 1st, 2018. Thank you.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the Worldbeat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife. Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rank and Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
Radio's greatest application is in broadcasting mass entertainment. Probably one of the best ways to get started is to make it a hobby and build an amateur station. It will show you more quickly than anything else whether or not you can succeed in radio.
KBOO, Portland.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters and Politics. On today's show,
one of the problems we have as American radicals is that we live in the United States of amnesia and we forget what went before. And in some ways, Donald Trump is an amnesia-producing machine because we look back and say, oh, George Bush, a war criminal, he wasn't that bad. But actually, he was that bad, and Reagan was that bad. So we can't allow ourselves to forget.
A conversation with Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn. They founded the group Weather Underground back in the early 1970s. We'll talk about the national political scene today. And then in the second half of today's program, our intern Lucille Rousseau sits down with Beverly Daniel Tatum, who is President Emerita at Spelman College.
We are becoming a much more diverse nation, and for some people, that slogan, Make America Great Again, that Donald Trump was championing, was heard perhaps as Make America White Again. Let's go back to a time when white people were clearly in charge. Let's go back to a time when it was 90% white.
Beverly Daniel Tatum is the author of the book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And Other Conversations About Race. That's next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. Former U.S. President Barack Obama cautioned for reserve when using social media today, without mentioning the name of President Donald Trump, who regularly uses Twitter to make announcements and berate those he disagrees with.
The question, I think, really has to do with how do we harness this technology in a way that allows a multiplicity of voices, allows a diversity of views, but doesn't lead to a balkanization of our society, but rather continues to promote ways of finding common ground. Mm-hmm. And one of the dangers of the internet is that people can have entirely different realities. They can be just cocooned in information that reinforces their current biases.
The former president made the comment during a pre-recorded interview with Britain's Prince Harry that aired on BBC Radio 4 today. 4 months after Hurricane Harvey hit the Gulf Coast, an estimated 8,000 Texans are still awaiting federal housing help, while FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, continues to auction off trailers it's purchased to house disaster victims. The Associated Press reports the federal government typically spends up to $150,000 apiece on trailers it leases to disaster victims, then auctions them for pennies on the dollar after 18 months of use, or with any sign of minor damage. The Department of Homeland Security says it's continued with that practice, even as nearly 8,000 Texas applicants affected by the hurricane await federal housing help. Reuters reports the International Committee of the Red Cross has rebuked a right-wing Israeli lawmaker after he boarded a bus carrying Palestinian relatives to visit their loved ones on an Israeli prison and hurled verbal abuse at them. Oren Hazan said on Twitter he told family members that their loved ones were terrorists who belonged in the ground. In a video clip on social media, he shouted at one prisoner's mother that her son was an insect and a dog. Israel 24 translated some of Hazan's remarks.
We're going to kick you out of here. Force and violence, it's not going to help anyone. Force and violence, it's not going to work anymore. You don't scare us and you don't deter us. We're going to wash your ugly smiles right off your faces. We don't care about you, and if you don't understand it when we talk nicely, you're going to understand with force. And if we decide to operate with force, it's going to hurt.
The Red Cross said in a statement it took seriously what Hazan had done, adding that families, quote, have the right to visit their loved ones in a dignified manner, unquote. Israel says it will name a planned railway station after U.S. President Donald Trump. Israel's transportation minister is pushing ahead with a plan to dig two railway tunnels under Jerusalem's Old City. It's a politically sensitive area and would likely face opposition from the international community, which doesn't recognize Israeli sovereignty over East Jerusalem. As the Trump administration considers a policy of separating undocumented families that are detained at the U.S.-Mexico border, immigrant rights advocates say it's already a de facto policy. A consortium of immigrant rights groups filed a complaint with the Department of Homeland Security's Officer of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties earlier this month, detailing more than a dozen cases of immigrant children who are separated from their families at the border. Katie Shepard is with the American Immigration Council.
We chose to lift up only about 15 or 16 case examples in the complaint itself, but really this is just an illustrative sample of the much larger number of families who are being separated along the entire U.S.-Mexico border, anywhere in the hundreds that we know of. Of course, this practice, we believe, happens every single day. The reports that we're hearing from the field are from individuals where the children are incredibly young, as young as 1 year old, which is incredibly cruel and runs against our legacy here in the United States to provide safe haven to those in need and also keep families together.
Shepard says while it's been an ongoing issue, they've documented an uptick in the practice of separating undocumented families brought into detention centers since this past summer, totaling more than 150 cases this year. I'm Christina Onnested. Letters and Politics is next.
And you're listening to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I'm very happy to welcome back to our radio station Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers. Bernadine Dorn, former professor of law at Northwestern University. Bill Ayers, an American elementary education theorist and former professor of education at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Together, they were involved with the Weather Underground during the late 60s and early 1970s. Very good to see you both again. Thank you for being here.
Mitch, it's wonderful to see you.
As always, thanks, Mitch.
You know, I almost want to start on a personal reflection here. You know, most of my life, I always thought about the 60s and the 70s. I was born in 1972. All my life, I felt like I missed history. History happened
before me. And I think about, and you two obviously were right in the middle of history happening during this period of time. And then 2011 happens, and we get this Occupy movement. I'm like, well, this is interesting. Although this feels kind of historic going on. And then it's just... Now I'm almost sorry I'm not missing history. You know, everything that has happened since. For you two, who were really, you know, in the center of what was going on in the 60s and the 70s, how do you compare and contrast that period of time till today?
You know, in a way, I think we begin by thinking that the 60s is mostly myth and symbol. It's sold back to us as a thing that happened. And we're very strong about living in the present, and we have no nostalgia for the 60s. And one way of thinking about it is that nobody looked at their watch on December 31st, 1969 and said, oh man, it's almost over. It's that, you know, nobody lives by decades. And in some ways, the mythologizing of the 60s, either the best time for the revolution or the devil's own handiwork, both of those images kind of strip young people today of their agency. And so we're very much of the moment and feel like what's happening now, you're absolutely right, Occupy, but now look, Standing Rock, Black Lives Matter, yeah. On and on.
Me Too. The Me Too campaign.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Me Too, yes. No, yeah. I think we're in the middle of it. And this is a rising tide. It's a time of resistance. It's a time of radical thinking, of studying, you know, Marxism, of thinking about theory. Because anybody with their eyes open can see now that we're in a crisis, serious crisis. Major damage is being done globally. Fascism is on the rise. And so you have to think about, you know, how does this all fit together and what can I do? And that feeling of being overwhelmed, of course, did characterize the 60s and other periods of time. Sure, we were absolutely overwhelmed. I mean, we know now that it was the FBI and the CIA and local police forces that were murdering Black Panther Party leaders across the country, and assassination programs were official. And they are now, of course. We still have Guantanamo. We still have, you know, massive surveillance. We're all carrying around our little surveillance devices. So I think my point is that when you're in opposition, when you're taking a stand against what is, however it is, as a teacher, as a lawyer, as a worker in a factory, however you're resisting, you are in a moment, and everybody is looking to kind of name this moment and see what they can do. But as Bill said, we tried really hard not to live in the past, mm-hmm. and to be in the present. So this is a time that's very exciting.
And I respect that, you don't want to mystify the past. But I just, you know, I find myself always wondering, wow, is this what it was like in the 60s?
Yeah. Well, one thing is that it's worth remembering that, for example, the Vietnam War, which everyone opposed, actually that's not true. When the Vietnam War started, 15% of Americans opposed the war. And those who stood up, history proved them right. But it wasn't a popular thing to do. It's also worth remembering that when King was assassinated, according to national polls, he was less popular than George W. Bush when Bush left office. It's worth remembering that the kids who sat in at the lunch counters, everyone in America except a tiny minority said they're hurting the cause. Now we look back and celebrate that. We celebrate the Black Panthers as we should. But at the time...
But we celebrate them in some ways by glorifying them beyond recognition so that this generation finds it's hard to think that we're in the same groundwork, you know, we're doing the same kinds of things that people did then. So I think that the glorification of the past is troubling. It's why we've always tried not to do it.
On Mount Olympus? Is that unattainable?
Exactly.
Is that your concern?
Well, unattainable, but also...
Or seems unattainable.
Yeah, also too good or too bad.
Mm-hmm. We're all human. You know? We all have feet of clay, and that was true then, and we're all confused about how to move forward. And you make choices in the dark, largely. That's true now. It was true then.
I had a moment, for example, where I had finally thrown myself in. I didn't come out of a left background or anything. Finally thrown myself into the struggle when Dr. King came to Chicago. And so I was out on the west side of Chicago with a little legal armband trying to learn from these people who had already been in the South and, to me, were bigger than life. So, you know, you have to realize that
doing, putting yourself in opposition, however you can do it, first step, second step, onward, is the hardest moment. Because it's easy to be reading the news, being depressed, feeling overwhelmed. But, you know, at that, in one moment on the west side of Chicago, we were trying to prevent people from being evicted. There was a citywide rent strike that Dr. King had called, and we were all out on the street trying to stop this family from being evicted. And suddenly, somebody stepped out of the crowd from next to me and went over and picked up a kitchen table that the sheriffs had brought down, carried it back up the stairs, and it was Muhammad Ali. During the period when he wasn't allowed to fight. And then the next person came up, and the next person, and eventually all of us carried their belongings, their clothes, their high chair, and so on, back upstairs, just past the sheriffs who stood there. So, you know, those kind of moments sound mythical. In a way they are, but they're every day also, and they're happening now.
And speaking of Muhammad Ali, it's just remarkable to me even to think, and I'm sort of getting used to it now, but the fact that this political environment has gotten all the way into the professional football.
Isn't that marvelous?
I mean, that's the one place I would be almost, and obvious many reasons you'd expect it to be there, right, when 70% of your players are African-American.
Exactly.
But in another way, it seems like that was the one place you weren't going to penetrate because of all the money and the prestige and...
But you think about it, go back a year, right, think about it, go back a year. What, you know, John Carlos and Tommy Smith did at the Olympics in 68, what Muhammad Ali did for his life, what Colin Kaepernick did a year ago, more than a year ago, were remarkable individual acts of protest, but they came out of a ferment, you know. Colin Kaepernick would not be possible without Black Lives Matter. Yeah. And then his act of courage spurred other people, and no one could have predicted when he took that risk and paid a price that he would become a symbol for something so powerful, and that he is such a down-to-earth guy. He came to Chicago and spent a couple hours with the Black Lives Matter kids a few months ago, never was in the media, never mentioned it, but just interacted with them around their movement. This is an exciting time, and anyone who wants to be involved can find a place in, and that's a beautiful thing.
Well, he's on a learning curve, and, you know, we're out here big Warriors fans, too. They're on a learning curve,
which they're very clear about.
You know? Well, but they're very clear about what the learning curve they're on, right?
Yeah,
they're
yeah.
doing political education and trying to figure out how they fit.
Yeah.
Not just as the greatest athletes, but, well, maybe Chicago Bulls, but them and Chicago Bulls, greatest athletes, but also human beings.
You mean Chicago Bulls is the second greatest NBA basketball team of all time?
Exactly.
To be decided.
Still being worked out. Speaking of still being worked out, what do you think's happening right now in our world? Is this a battle between which direction the country can go? Could it go in one direction that, you know, is led by people like Colin Kaepernick, maybe Rebecca Solnit is mm-hmm. somebody I admire very much.
I admire her so much, yeah.
Maybe, or could it go the direction, a backlash perhaps to all these social movements we've seen and a direction that Trump's?
You know, one of the things that happened after the Trump election while we were all in shock, certainly I couldn't have predicted the Trump election, is that it was really becoming clear that anybody who thinks that the United States is not capable of a neo-fascist regime hasn't been paying attention. So, yes, there has always been, an armed attack force, white supremacist attack force against African Americans in the United States, or against Native Americans and against immigrants, and particularly Latina immigrants or Chinese immigrants. So you know, of course, we all know that. That's always there. But when you see it cohered, and that's what Trump's done, he's cohered those various disparate forces of proto-fascist, neo-fascist, fascist, right-wing armed forces now, and seeing them cohered is even more frightening. But to be surprised a year later, we can't still be surprised. We could have been surprised at the beginning, but we can't be surprised anymore. We have to figure out what we can do as part of the resistance.
And I think naming this political moment, like all political moments, it's a moment of contestation, but we're in a period where kind of crypto neo-fascism is a response to the failures of neoliberalism. We're seeing a society in permanent war. We're seeing a society with a militarized police force and mass incarceration. I think we're also seeing the pushback, and you mentioned Me Too, but the exciting thing, this is a moment when the whole structure of male supremacy and the structure of white supremacy is being exposed. And so, you know, I get very nervous when I see somebody like Mitch McConnell say, I believe the women. And I want to immediately say, you believe the women. Do you believe them when they say they should have control of their own uteruses without doubt? Do you believe them when they say that they should have
equal
a living
pay.
Wage and equal pay? You know, do you believe them when they say that we shouldn't have to be forced into marriage in order to have health coverage and so on? So I think it's a time to really go deep and to provide an opposition and a real alternative, and I think we're in that moment.
One of the things that we admire about the young activists now and try to be in solidarity with them is that they are, they connect the issues. For us, eventually, in my generation, we were able to connect the Black Freedom Movement and the movement against the war in Vietnam. But today, I think young activists connect issues quite appropriately. And so keeping them integrated and as connected it seems to me to be one of their great strengths. They're not going through total ideological hoops in order to realize that it's, at the heart of it is the failure of imperialism and capitalism to solve our problems. Can't solve the climate problem. Can't do it. I mean, just trying to get here today shows you that maybe the most beautiful city in the world can't deal with the cars and the traffic. So those contradictions writ large, I think, are obvious to young activists. And I love it that they can do this.
And there's a lot of reframing going on. I mean, I agree with Vijay Prashad that the calling it climate change is almost too mild. It sounds like the wind changed its mind, when actually it's capitalist planetary destruction, and it's huge. And we have our generation, this generation, is being called to stop it. And so that's what we imagine.
Hey, you mentioned we get a Trump presidency coming out of a base of neoliberalism. And he's an objection in some ways to neoliberalism. Do you think a Trump presidency, in some ways, maybe not in others, taking on the establishment is a good thing? Shaking it up?
No, I don't think it's a good thing. Too many people are suffering from, what's being done around healthcare, what's being done now around taxes. Now we're opening up the Arctic to drilling. It's not a good thing, but it's the thing we've got. So we don't get to pick our historical moment. This is the historical moment you have, and I have by, choice. So I think that it's not good, but it's what we've got. And I think it does offer us the opportunity to really unite and resist, and to recognize that we're all connected,
Right.
The Me Too moment is about sexual harassment, but it's about patriarchy. It's big. It's a big structural issue that goes to when I was in my first women's consciousness group, I think women earned 59 cents to the dollar for men. And now it's 79. Okay, well, it's sort of progress, but that's 45 years to get that far, and it's not equality.
Yeah, and we can't wish for more pain for people in order to kind of expose the contradictions. We just can't. And so we fight for reforms, equal pay. We fight for, an end to police violence. But to really win, we have to always keep in mind what we're against is the structure of white supremacy. Now, we're not fighting for body cameras on cops. We're fighting for the end to the structure baked into history and law and culture. And that's true
of police violence against people of color.
Right. So we have to always fight for reforms with a consciousness that there's something bigger that we're going toward.
We're in conversation with Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn. Bernadine Dorn's former professor of law at Northwestern University. Bill Ayers is former professor of education at University of Illinois Chicago, of course, formerly with the Weather Underground and anti-war activist. Bill Ayers, you mentioned something I want to dive into, and that is continuing war.
Yeah.
I'm actually preparing for another interview about how the Roman Republic became a Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. And part of that dynamic, a very important part of that dynamic, is Rome's conquest of other territory, how large it got, and permanent war, what that did to society. Do you think we overlook the fact that we've been in war since 2001? I mean, you can make an argument before then, but at least the war on terrorism since 2001.
Yeah, well, we've been in permanent war practically from the moment Europeans landed on the continent. And we should remember that context. One of the problems we have as American radicals is that we live in the United States of amnesia, and we forget what went before. And in some ways, Donald Trump is an amnesia-producing machine, because we look back and say, oh, George Bush, a war criminal, he wasn't that bad. But actually, he was that bad, and Reagan was that bad. So we can't allow ourselves to forget. But yes, we have been in an announced permanent war since George W. Bush. We have the biggest military behemoth ever created in the history of the world, and still act as if we need more.
We're in active droning and active warfare against 9 countries around the world, but military bases in over 100 places in the world.
500, so, I think, yeah.
They're just, you know, well, there's not that many countries, but 500
military bases, though, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the disproportion. I think what we have is a collapsing economy or a weakening economy, capitalism, I don't know what, you know, unable to solve the problems. And we have, a cultural dominance of the world and a military dominance of the world. So while some of the things are weakening, the military strength of the United States, the overwhelming money that goes into it, the rebuilding of nuclear weapons, the threatening of war on the Korean Peninsula, this stuff is crazy and real. And the rest of the world is assuming that it's real. I think
our situation with North Korea is not top of the news every day, as Rush says something about where we are today.
It's very frightening. And we have the strength, I think, of veterans coming back telling the truth. That's, to me, one of our critical strengths. We have, you know, the Iraqi and Afghan vets against the war, but now decades of the Vietnam veterans. And I think they've united now in Veterans for Peace. This is a great strength, and if people don't know what to do, I urge everybody to go find them and support them and work with them. But I think connecting that issue of permanent war with the issues that we just talked about women's liberation and about, you know, freedom for African Americans from daily exclusion and violence, these things have to be put together for us.
But, you know, and I think, you know, we talk about what's new and what's old. I think to have a president of the United States stand in front of the United Nations and threaten genocide against an entire country, which Donald Trump did against North Korea, is extraordinary. And I think it normalizes what is horrendous.
I hear a hope for what's happening with social movements, a concern about what's happening with other social movements. It seems like one going more towards the left, the other one going more towards the right. Does that dynamic concern you? We've seen a rise in political violence, albeit probably on the margins, but still. I've seen Trump supporters and Antifa go at it just right here in downtown Berkeley. I never thought I'd see that. You know, again, another one of those moments where I'm like, oh my goodness.
Right.
Things have really changed.
Well, they're in motion, and we're in crisis, and imperialism in decline, empire in decline, is never pretty, and it's often very, very difficult. But I think that what we have to hope for, and I'm not an optimist, but I'm not a pessimist, and I'm neither of those things, because we don't know how things are going to turn out. But I do think that we wake up every morning with hope that if we organize, if we reach out, if we can kind of name the issues appropriately, accurately, and get people in motion, that we can change the world, and that we have to, our work is dream work, of course, and we have to commit to that, and we have to commit to it every day, and that's what we do.
Well, you know that we're an armed society. Probably the only people who aren't armed are some of us, but I think that it's dangerous. It's also clear that our children are watching, and we have to take a stand, and that stand doesn't have to be ultra heroic. You know, it can be doing concrete work for good organizations, or for with a group of friends, or with a group of women, or with a group of people who live on your block. We just had everybody over for a brunch at our house this year, and it was fascinating.
Everybody? Well, who's everybody?
Well, I leafleted the block because, you know, right after Trump, people were saying, talk to your neighbors. Now our neighbors in Chicago, on the south side of Chicago, you know, I don't think there was a Trump supporter among them. But what there was a variety of people who were doing something through their church, through their schools or their kids' schools. They were doing something. They were doing teach-ins. They were doing asylum work. And I think that's the hopeful part of this moment, that we have to resist because we don't get to pick our history, our moment. We're alive now, and that's what we have to do.
Bill Ayers, Bernadine Dorn, thank you both.
Mitch, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Cesarich. Coming up after the musical break, our intern. And we are quite lucky to have interns, including this intern, Lucille Rousseau, is going to sit down with Beverly Daniel Tatum for a conversation on her new book called Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race. Beverly Daniel Tatum is also President Emerita at Spelman College. And again, she'll speak with our intern, Lucille Rousseau, after this.
Welcome to Letters and Politics. I am Lucille Rousseau. Today, we're in conversation with Professor Beverly Daniel Tatum about her book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And Other Conversations About Race. 20 years after the success of this national bestseller, she updates her theory to include the major events American society has faced since the beginning of the century. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This book gives keys to understand the construction of racial identity and the dynamics behind self-segregation that we can observe, especially in high schools. On this matter, some thinkers suggest that self-segregation is an instinctive tendency. Do you agree that humans have a predisposition to stay with similar people? And why is this self-segregation an issue?
Well, let me start out by saying that we as human beings do have a tendency to want to congregate with others. We're social animals, social beings, and we often also have the tendency to categorize things in a very basic way into us and them. But how we define who belongs in the us category and who belongs in the them category is learned. We don't come into the world knowing who belongs in the S category or who belongs in the them category. We get that information from the attitudes and behaviors we observe in our parents, our leaders in school, leaders in our nation. And so one of the things I talk about in my book is the importance of leadership in helping us bridge the racial divides we experience in our society, because it's not instinct to say, you know, people who look like this are not part of my group. People who pray like that are not part of my group. That is learned information which we look to our leaders to help us know how to define. So it is, when we think about the pattern that's described in the title of my book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria in Racially Mixed High Schools? And certainly that is a common observation. And of course, it's not just the black kids. It's the Latinx kids. It's the Asian kids. It's the white kids who are separating themselves along these lines. They're doing that because they have grown up in a race-conscious society, and they are responding to the characteristics of that society, which has told them that people who look like this, people who do these things, belong in groups together. It is a natural thing to look for people who have a shared experience with you, who have a similar set of experiences that you can talk about what's going on in your life. They'll understand it. They'll understand the slang you use. They'll understand the food you're eating. They'll understand the jokes you're telling, the music you want to listen to. But when we think about education and how we are preparing young people to connect across lines of difference so that they are able to function effectively in a diverse democracy, then we have to think about not only who's sitting with who in the lunchroom, but what we're doing in the classroom to encourage young people to develop those social skills.
Do you think that the school system, through curriculum and codes, legitimizes one racial culture over another?
I do think that if you look at the history of education in the United States, one of the things that we can see is that there has been certainly a pattern of school segregation, and that school segregation has been based on assumptions about a racial hierarchy, white supremacy. The reason that black kids were kept out of white schools was because they were believed to be inferior to those white children. And those assumptions, while not articulated in the same way today in the 21st century, the legacy of those attitudes can still be found in how schools are structured. So if we look at how children are assigned in high school to advanced placement classes or honors classes versus courses that are not part of a college-bound curriculum, we are more likely to find low-income and children of color in those lower classes. Often they are struggling with the fact that the expectations for their school performance is not the same as that of more affluent children or white children in a middle-class setting. So we know that we have to look at how our schools are structured and the patterns that have been reinforced over generations if we really want to create more equitable schooling and to create an environment where kids are learning to engage with one another.
In order to define racism, in your book, you compare racism in society to smog in the air. Can you develop this metaphor so that our listeners can understand what racism involves for you?
First of all, I make a distinction between prejudice and racism. Prejudice is, of course, having to do with individual attitudes, often based on misinformation or stereotypes. And I talk about the fact that that misinformation, those stereotypes, those omissions, those distortions of information that we experience as we're growing up from, you know, our very early years into our school age years and into adulthood, that misinformation is like smog in the air. It's very hard to avoid. It's very hard to avoid being exposed to stereotypes about people who have been marginalized in our society because they're so pervasive in the books we read, in the television we watch, in the comments or jokes we hear people tell. And that pervasiveness is, as I talk about in the book, like smog in the air. And most of us would not describe ourselves as, quote, smog breathers. But if we live in a smoggy place, we, in fact, are breathing smog day in and day out. And so it should not surprise us that we all, at some level, have absorbed some misinformation, some stereotypes that influence how we think about or interact with other people. But those attitudes, that smog we've been breathing, while it impacts all of us, and as I like to say, if you breathe some in, occasionally you might find that you've breathed some out, that we have to think about our goal as to not say, oh, no, I haven't been breathing any smog. Our goal is to think about how can we collectively clean up the air so that we don't reinforce those patterns. So racism is really, I use a definition that came through the work of David Wellman, a sociologist, and he defined racism as a system of advantage based on race. Just as we might talk about sexism as a system of advantage based on sex or gender, heterosexism, a system of advantage based on sexual orientation, or classism, a system of advantage based on socioeconomic status. And if we think about that system of advantage, it includes policies and practices that have been put in place that systematically advantage one group over another.
Applying this definition of racism, can white people be anti-racists?
Absolutely. There's another analogy that I use in the book that some people find helpful, which is to think of that system of advantage as like a moving walkway, a sidewalk, like at the airport. Yeah. If you step onto that moving sidewalk or that moving walkway at the airport, sometimes if it's moving very slowly, you might be standing on it and not even notice that it's moving, but still you're being carried along. But if we think about the fact that that moving walkway is always in motion, if we want to interrupt it, we can't just say it's not moving. We have to turn around. If we don't want to go where that walkway is carrying us, we have to turn around and not just stand still, because if you did that, if you imagined yourself just turning around but not moving, now you're still being carried along, but you're going backwards, right? Yeah. You don't see where you're going. If you don't like this momentum, this racist momentum in our society, if you don't like that, then you have to turn around and walk actively in the opposite direction. You have to walk actively to interrupt those policies and practices to bring about new change that will be more equitable. And that effort is what I call being anti-racist.
And to what extent does the American Society of White Privilege we were talking about impact the identity development of Black adolescents?
So when we think about identity development of young people of color, Black adolescents, Latinx, Asian, Native American, if you think about growing up in a race-conscious society where you start to become aware, usually in adolescence, of the ways in which that society sees you as outside the mainstream. Every adolescent is asking the question of who am I and what do I hope to be in my future and how do other people see me? All adolescents do that. But young people who are targeted by racism have another layer to think about. And as a consequence of that, they start to think about what their identity in the context of the racism around them. It's often at that time when they start to look for young people who understand what that experience is like. You might find that the kindergartners, the first graders, the second graders are all sitting in mixed groups. They're not necessarily sitting together. But as children get older, they do start to separate out into those racially defined groups, in part because they're having racially defined experiences.
I come from France, and in France, we have a completely different way of dealing with race. And talking about race, asking someone about their race, even for a survey, is illegal. The word race itself is considered as jeopardizing the core principle that all human beings are born equal. And so I'm wondering, do you think that American society could benefit from such a perspective?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. You know, I, of course, have been to France, but I haven't spent much time in there, and I didn't know what you shared, that the that even asking about race is illegal. Certainly I think the attitude in France speaks to the fact that we are all human. That, you know, the racial distinctions that are so commonly referred to in the United States, we know are not biologically defined. They're social constructions. You know, a light brown skinned person in the United States who is considered Black might be considered so-called colored in South Africa, or might be considered white in Brazil. It's the same person, but the categories are different.
And how does this race identification, part of American culture as opposite of French way of thinking about it, impact the construction of identity?
Well, I think the fact that we do categorize people and talk about those categories and that even young children start to learn what those categories are, even preschoolers are starting to know what those categories are. The fact that it's so much a part of our culture means that we are creating an environment where young people know that these categories matter.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to point out something which has to do with this generation of young people. And by that I mean, you know, young people who are 20 years old today. My book originally was published in 1997, and this is the 20th anniversary update. And one of the reasons I wanted to update it was because I knew that there were young people coming of age right now whose life experiences have been different than previous generations. For a lot of people, a lot of young people, I think it is a confusing time because on the one hand, you can point to signs of progress, like the election of President Obama, and yet there seems to be a lot happening that seems more akin to what was going on before the Civil Rights Movement than after it. It is a time when I think we need more dialogue about race and racism in our society, not less, so that we can begin to move forward again as a society, creating a more racially equitable one. I think not talking about it does not serve us well.
And speaking about the process of construction of identity, in your book you use the concept of oppositional identity as a way of constructing a group identity, not only through what people have in common, but also through their difference from others. For instance, you notice that Black adolescents use the term acting white pejoratively.
Yeah, let's talk about this idea of acting white. So from the point of view of a young Black adolescent who's trying to figure out what does it mean to be an African American, keep in mind that school segregation is a pattern that is longstanding in the United States and has not changed over the last 20 or 30 years. In fact, if it has changed, it's gotten more segregated than it was previously. So when we think about what it means to a young adolescent, a Black adolescent, who's trying to figure out, as all adolescents are, what does it mean to be part of my group? What does it mean to be a young person coming of age in a race-conscious society? Sometimes that definition of what it means to be Black is defined in opposition to stereotypes about whiteness. So if I think that Black kids listen to a certain kind of music, I might spend more time listening to hip-hop, let's say, than show tunes, right? You know, because I'm defining that as something that fits with my definition of what being Black means. Now, part of the challenge for an adolescent is to think broadly about that. You know, there are Black people who like show tunes, I'm sure. There are Black people who listen to opera or who sing in operas, but that might not be part of your definition when you're 13 or 14 or 15, because you might not have been exposed to that information or you might not know about it. And as a consequence, you may be working with a very narrow definition of what it means to be Black, and that narrow definition is often based on cultural stereotypes and what you see immediately around you in your peer group. If you see someone, another Black student, whose behavior doesn't match up with what you think is Black, you may label that person, quote, acting white. You might label that person acting white because they're dressing differently than you do, because they listen to a different kind of music than you think they should, because they are speaking with a different accent than you do. And often that term, when it's used, is being used pejoratively. But when we ask the question, well, why do they do that? Why do young people do that? It just has everything to do with trying to figure out what is my identity and what are the characteristics that define it. I often say to educators that if we really want to help young people who are, we know, are going through this identity development process, one way we can help them is to help expand their understanding of what the options are and have been for people who look like them.
Again, we're in a conversation with Professor Beverly Danielle Tatum, author of the book Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And Other Conversations About Race, a revised and updated edition of the national bestseller published 20 years ago. How do you explain that your book is still relevant 20 years after?
Well, you know, I have to say when I wrote it in 1997, I did not imagine that I would be updating it and in some ways completely rewriting it again 20 years later. Certainly, one of the things that is a disappointment is that we haven't made more progress in dismantling the system of advantage that we call racism in our society. We have, of course, made progress over my lifetime. I was born in 1954, and I take some pride in having been born the year of Brown versus Board of Education. You know, from 1954 to 2017, we have seen change. But if you're looking at just the last 20 years, it's not so encouraging.
Do you think that generally it is worse or better?
I think that in some, you know, there's certainly progress in some areas, but I think we have seen also some backward motion. So, for example, public education is more segregated today than it was 20 years ago. Neighborhoods remain about the same. We haven't seen much change in terms of neighborhood desegregation. Certainly, we know that there's been expanded opportunities in the employment sector for African Americans and other people of color. But when we look at the research that sociologists are doing today, they still find significant patterns of employment discrimination still operating. So we know that while there has been, in my lifetime, you know, the 63 years that I've been alive, there has been progress. I think it's also important to say that progress is often two steps forward, one step back. Two steps forward, one step back. And I think we are in a step backward moment right this minute. And it is for that reason that at the end of my book, I wanted to include examples of people and places who are taking action to try to move us forward again. Because it is certainly important for every listener to recognize that we all influence other people. Mm-hmm. We all influence our children, our family members, our friends, our coworkers, our fellow worshipers in our faith communities. We all have a sphere of influence. And if we were to intentionally use that sphere of influence to raise questions about the status quo, to ask questions about how we might do things more fairly, more equitably, how we might start to dismantle that smog, clean up the air, as we were talking about earlier, I think we would see more progress than we're seeing right now.
One of the most important events of the last 20 years that has influenced the way American society deals with race was the historic election and re-election of President Barack Obama. And as you say in your book, as I quote, challenged the fundamental social narrative in American culture. And so I'm wondering, to what extent has this impact American society? And then can you explain us how Trump's election has changed this fundamental social narrative in American culture?
We all in our culture seen many stories where there's a contest between a white character and a black character or a character of color. And inevitably, the story usually ends with the white character coming out on top. And so when President Obama was elected, it was a surprise ending that the black candidate could be the winner. And I think many people were surprised by that. And right after the election in 2008, there was a survey done by USA Today where a number of, where the survey had to do with how people felt about this outcome. And many people, even though some of the respondents had not actually voted for Barack Obama in that election, the majority of people, close to 70%, said that they felt it was a positive statement about race relations in the United States that he had been elected. At the same time, there was a significant percentage, about 24%, that said they were frightened by the result. And the day after his election, there was a surge in online activity on hate sites, white supremacist hate sites. And so we see both this desire for racial progress and embracing it as a positive thing, and at the same time, anxiety about it being expressed by a certain segment of the population. And since his election, we've seen a rise in hate group activity. If we fast forward to 2016, some people have argued that the election of Donald Trump was in some ways a direct response to the election of President Obama, in a sense, a kind of backlash against the progress that that represented. And particularly in the context of a changing demographic, we haven't talked much about that in this conversation, but it is important to point out that over the last 20 years, our nation has become much more racially diverse than it was.
Yeah.
In the 1950s, the U.S. population was 90% white. In the 2017s, you know, today, our population is much more diverse, particularly among young people. In 2014, it was the first year that in our public schools, the population of children was 50% or more kids of color, meaning Black, Latinx, Asian, Native American, multiracial. And so that rapidly changing population, as we get, as that young group grows up, we are becoming a much more diverse nation. And for some people, that slogan, Make America Great Again, that Donald Trump was championing, was heard perhaps as Make America White Again. Let's go back to a time when white people were clearly in charge. Let's go back to a time when it was 90% white. Let's go back to a time when there was less immigration, particularly immigrants of color coming into the United States. And so while those who chose to vote for Donald Trump, you know, might have had multiple reasons, it is certainly the case that the largest sector of voters were white voters. In terms of his base, his electoral base, and that perhaps some nostalgia for an America that was less diverse is part of what was driving some of that decision making.
So how do you expect this situation of self-segregation to evolve over the next 20 years? And as you say, especially if you can talk more about the demographic change that is happening and will continue happening, and how it impacts American minds.
Well, certainly we know that if we just look at the population growth, you know, where not just where the immigration is coming from in terms of who's coming into the United States, but, you know, just look at differential birth rates and again, the diversity in the young population, we know that this population change, the demographic change, is going to continue. That is very likely to continue. But the question of the phrase you used was self-segregation. You know, if you walk into a school 10 years from now, 20 years from now, will we see a high school, if we walk into a high school, will we see Black kids sitting together, white kids sitting together, Latinx children sitting together? The answer might be yes, but I think the question that I think is more critical than who's sitting together in the cafeteria, the question that I think is most important is, what are we doing, those of us who are educators, whether we're working in elementary schools, middle schools, high schools, or colleges and universities, what are we doing as educators and parents to help our children learn how to engage with people different from themselves? Those developmental experiences are part of what allow you to be successful as an adult. And that is, I think, the real critical question. Not, you know, why are all the black kids sitting together in the cafeteria, but how are we helping all the kids learn how to navigate in a diverse world?
Professor Beverly Danielle Tatum has been our guest. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
She is the author of the book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race.
And that does it for Letters in Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez, Abby Klinkenberg, and Lucille Rousseau. Our engineer is Kristen Thomas. If you'd like to find previous shows, you can go to our archives at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Joserich, and I thank you for listening.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Hi, I'm David Brower, David R. Brower, and I add the R because there are 100 other David Browers in the United States, and that keeps me separate from most of them. I like the direction you're going in, KBOO, Portland, and I wish you had a lot more company.
This is Press Watch, a counter propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported